On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And today, a Tasmanian senator looks for answers over the sale of the state's biggest farm, Rushy Lagoon.
The fact that the government's looking to subsidise the conversion of a very productive irrigated beef and dairy farm to grow trees for a foreign company to sell carbon credits to other foreign companies, I think that's a completely wrong exercise.
And the dung beetles from South Australia helping out in a northwest Tasmanian dairy.
I suppose as organic farmers, we have very limited inputs that we can use. And so we're always looking for ways to harness nature to make our farm more productive and more resilient. And dung beetles are just something that really do an enormous amount of good.
Yeah, swapping Tasmanian dung beetles for South Australian dung beetles coming up on the Country Hour today. And they make the journey via Australia Post as well. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Friday, where we also hear from a Tasmanian senator asking questions on the floor of the Senate about the sale of Tasmania's largest farm, Rushy Lagoon. That story coming up in just a moment. Also today, the numbers of cattle in feedlots across the country has doubled in the past decade. We'll find out why. And Richard Bailey will be along later in the program to let us know what's happening with the livestock markets, both here and on the mainland. A check on the weather in around about 10 minutes from now. And you too can be part of the Country Hour via that text line. 0438 922 936 is that number. First up, it's understood the review process for the sale of Tasmania's biggest farm is in its final stages. Foreign Investment Review Board has requested multiple extensions to assess the application from a UK forestry investor to purchase Rushy Lagoon in the state's northeast. Tasmanian Senator Richard Colbeck says he doesn't have a problem with forestry, but with where Gresham House is getting some of its funding from.
It's an issue I've been talking about for a while, actually. I've raised it a number of times in the Parliament. I'm concerned that the government is subsidising a sale to a foreign entity to convert the property from irrigated beef and dairy to trees. I mean, I'm someone who's supported forestry for a long time, but I think this is the wrong thing in the wrong place. The subsidisation of the sale and the subsequent market distortion is of great concern to me. Foreign investment on equal terms I don't have a problem with, but I don't see why the government should be subsidising the sale of this very significant property, and it reflects the concerns that have been put to me by farming groups and people in the broader community about this particular consideration that's in front of the government right now.
Have you confirmed the level of investment from the Clean Energy Finance Corporation towards Gresham House's purchase of the property?
It's been very difficult to get actual numbers, but I understand it's in the order of $20 million, and that's a significant proportion of the property value, particularly when you're looking at the overall reported sale price. But I don't think it really matters what it is. The fact that the government's looking to subsidise the conversion of a very productive irrigated beef and dairy farm to grow trees for a foreign company to sell carbon credits to other foreign companies, I think that's a completely wrong exercise. And in the context of how this process would be approved or otherwise through the Foreign Investment Review Board, I don't think it's in the national interest. So that's why I'm saying what I'm saying. That's why I'm having the conversations that I'm having with TAS farmers. That's the view that they have expressed to me as well. And so I'm representing that view from my local community in the Parliament.
Stephen Scala is the chair of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation and a director of the Foreign Investment Review Board. Is that a clear conflict of interest?
Well, it is on the face of it, and I think the government should explain to the community how they're managing that conflict of interest. That's the important thing. My question is how you get a fair deal when you have those sorts of circumstances in place. The government should be saying quite openly and publicly what it's doing to manage that conflict of interest. Clearly, there's a decision-making process in terms of the funding to be provided as a part of the sale, and of course then there's the decision-making process as to whether it's in the public interest or not, as from a Foreign Investment Review Board perspective. And so how the government is managing that conflict of interest is a material issue.
Have you raised concerns directly with Treasurer Jim Chalmers?
I wrote to the Treasurer some time ago, in fact, twice now. I've not received any response from the government. I've asked questions at estimates. I've raised the matter in the Parliament probably two or three times now, but I've not had any correspondence or response from the government in terms or from any minister, for that matter, in relation to this issue.
Is that to be expected during a Foreign Investment Review Board process while this review is happening? Is that a typical kind of response?
I would have expected at least an acknowledgement that I'd communicated. I've not even had that. My first communication was in March when I forwarded a letter expressing concerns about this proposal from TasFarmers to the Treasurer. I've not even had acknowledgement of that, and neither have they. And so the government has not shown any respect to anybody on this particular proposals at all, not even acknowledging the fact that concerns have been raised. And I've written twice now, not received any response, and I don't, as I understand it, neither have TasFarmers.
What level of communication have you had with the state and federal agriculture ministers?
I haven't spoken directly to Julie Collins, but we've had communication with the state government on this on a number of occasions. And I know that in an agricultural sense, there's concern from the agriculture minister down there with respect to what's happening here. I haven't looked specifically at public statements from the Tasmanian agriculture minister, but I know that there's been a number of conversations with colleagues here in the Parliament who are also interested and concerned directly with the Tasmanian Agriculture Minister. I'll repeat my view in respect of the proposed sale to Gresham to convert the property for trees supported by subsidy from the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, and that is that I don't think that this is in the national interest. So that's a simple perspective. That is grounds for the government to say that they're not going to agree to the sale. I understand that there are other players in the market who are interested. If Gresham is genuinely interested without subsidisation from the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, let them compete in the market without that subsidisation.
That's Tasmanian Liberal Senator Richard Colbeck in Canberra speaking with Larissa Smith. He's raised the sale of the 22,000-hectare Rushy Lagoon. In federal parliament this week, both the dairies on the farm have been closed and around 1,000 pregnant cows have been sent south to South Gippsland at least. The last of the consignments leaving the property this week, and the beef cattle herd remains on the farm. Treasurer Jim Chalmers has been contacted for comment. Well, the Tasmanian Primary Industries Minister Gavin Pearce was asked a question by Labor MP Janie Finlay about Rushy Lagoon at the recent budget estimates hearings in State Parliament.
I'm interested in the challenges being faced in the northeast as a result of a potential sale of Rushy Lagoon. Just wondering what advocacy you're doing on behalf of that in response to those concerns.
To that end, for those that don't know, I'm not explaining it to you, but I'm explaining to other members of the committee, that's 22,000 and something hectare property at Rushy, that the proposed sale of which would put that in the hands of a foreign investor in the form of Gresham House from the United Kingdom. They intend to, and they've already publicly stated that they intend to put at least 8,500 hectares of that property down to Pinus radiata. I have written to the Federal Treasurer because, you know, that the sentiment from our farmer industry, and you would have heard it, has been pretty strong against that. I've written and outlined that to Jim Chalmers, the Federal Treasurer, in his capacity as the caretaker minister of the Foreign Investment Review Board, of which that process will need to go through. I've also spoken to several colleagues that are in a similar position. You know, one of the big concerns that they have, I'm trying to get to the bottom of whether the federal government, with the Clean Energy Future Fund, whether that has been accessed or not. It's very difficult for me to find that information out. But I will state for the record that personally I am against any distortion of the purchaser's ability at the market stage. So if I'm a farmer, you're a farmer, and all of a sudden you want to plant trees, you get some sort of incentive from a future energy carbon type funding stream, then that advantages you compared to us as normal farmers. And I've articulated that to not only Mr. Chalmers, but also the minister.
Can I ask at a state level whether you've done any creative thinking about how the state might be able to intervene and secure for Tasmania's emerging farmers, young farmers who are being accessed out of land?
Yep, and to that end, I looked at the whole property because, you know, the number that was floated around initially, anecdotally, was somewhere between 8 and 8,500 hectares that they're going to put in with pine. I got a meeting happening with the mayor. And a number of local people with Gresham House, whether they could lease or buy or, you know, certain blocks may not be the whole lot. I don't think anything come of that, but at least it was something I need to try out. In terms of intervening in that process, it's difficult for me or anyone from the state to... We can't stop that. This is not North Korea. But and we've got a number of processes that need to go through in terms of checks and balances for foreign investment review boards in terms of, you know, there'll be requirements under the Clean Energy Future Fund that they'll need to go through as well. I have articulated very clearly to Jim Chalmers exactly what the farming community of Tasmania feels about this.
Tasmanian Primary Industries Minister Gavin Pearce answering a question from Labor MP Janie Finlay in the farm Rushy Lagoon at the recent budget estimates hearings in Parliament House. We shall check the weather for you in just a moment.
Joel Reinberger for Afternoons.
How long is it since you washed your water bottle properly? What is living on the lip of the water bottle where your lips kiss it several times a day? Dee Carter, Professor in Microbiology.
We all have water bottles that we haven't washed for way too long. Metal's definitely the best.
Here's Tom Gleeson's thoughts.
I work at the ABC now. Everyone's got a stainless steel reusable water bottle. Gotta rehydrate.
Afternoons with Joel. Next level.
It really is.
Weekdays on 936 ABC Hobart. It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
On the Friday edition of the Country Hour, time to check the latest on the weather. Ursula Connor joins us from the Bureau. Hello, Ursula.
Hi, Tony.
What's happening with the weather at the moment? Any rainfall of any note?
No, nothing to mention. Today, Tony, we're still under that ridge of high pressure, which is really going to remain in place right through the weekend as well. So very dry and settled conditions over the state at the moment. We saw another one of those cool, sort of frosty mornings for inland parts. Devonport and Wynyard actually had their coldest starts to the day. We were down to just below zero in Wynyard and around 2 degrees in Devonport. So coldest morning so far this year, Tony.
Yeah, what are the temperatures like at the moment in the major centres?
At the moment, we're around 11 degrees in Hobart, Launceston 11.5, Devonport's now up to 10, Wynyard 11, and over in St Helens nearly 13 degrees, Tony. So we're all just about at our maximums at the moment, pretty clear skies through much of the state. It's really just that low cloud hanging in the west coast at the moment.
Okay, so what are the expectations as we head into another weekend?
Over the weekend, very similar to what we have been seeing, Tony. So that high pressure system is really going to linger over the state for the weekend. So more dry days, potentially a little bit more sunshine around, not expecting as much cloud, especially through the west coast over the weekend. But that does mean we're probably in for some even colder nights. So widespread frost expected on both Saturday and Sunday mornings, Tony, and not expecting to see those maximum temperatures warm up much past sort of 11 and 12 degrees for most of the major centres over the weekend.
Yeah, now after the weekend into next week, we're looking at maybe a bit more rain?
Yeah, that's right. A bit of a change in the weather from Monday. We'll see the flow tend a little bit more northerly. So that'll actually mean it's a little bit warmer. We'll lose those sort of frosty nights. And the maximum temperatures during the day is, you know, around those sort of mid-teens. So a little bit less chill in the air, but we will start to see some showers developing. So they'll be mainly about the north and the west, sort of starting to develop on Monday. And we're really going to see those showers persist for much of next week. We've got a big low pressure system, which is approaching the west coast through pretty well the whole of next week, Tony. So a few like fronts and troughs embedded in that northwesterly flow. We'll see a few showers make it through to sort of their southern and eastern parts of the state as well, but expecting to see some pretty decent accumulations of rainfall over sort of Monday to Friday next week through the western and northern parts of the state, Tony.
Okay, what sort of mills are we expecting maybe?
Over the 5 days, pretty broadly speaking, across the north and the west, we could be between around 50 to 100 millimetres, maybe even over 100 millimetres for some of the elevated areas. And, you know, through the south and east, which isn't expecting to see as much, we're probably looking at around less than 20 millimetres.
Okay. Now, warnings. Are we warning free again? How many days is that?
Yes, we are warning free again, and I dare say that will continue for the next couple at least, Tony.
All right. Now, for people wanting to go boating or maybe do a bit of fishing, the coastal waters and swell, looking okay?
Yeah, pretty good time to be out on the water, Tony. I wish I was. We're very calm at the moment. Most of the coastal observations are pretty variable in direction with that high pressure system overhead of us, but between sort of 5 and 10 knots at the moment. As we move into tomorrow and that high pressure centre sits sort of just off our northeast there, most of the coastal waters will be somewhere between a northwest to southwesterly, probably between 5 to 15 knots, and then pretty variable below 10 knots about the northeast where that high pressure centre is. In terms of the swells through the west and south, we're looking at a southwesterly increasing to 2.5 to 3.5 metres tomorrow. In the north, a westerly below 1 metre, and in the east, a south to southwesterly of 1 to 2 metres.
And any news on the wave riders?
Nothing at this stage, Tony. We'll be waiting a while for the Cape Sorrel one. Apparently we need parts from Canada for that one. But the Maria Island boys still been a bit intermittent. The last observation I have is 7:30 last night, so that was reading around 1.1 metre, that southerly swell there.
Yeah, there wouldn't be too much change, would there?
No, the forecast hasn't really changed, so that's probably not too bad of a proxy.
Beauty. Thanks, Ursula.
Cheers, Tony. Have a good one.
You too. Ursula Connor from the Bureau with the latest information for you on the weather. Tiprat says only 2 millimetres at Myina up in the Central Highlands. Not too much about at the moment, but a fair bit expected in certain areas next week. Now, coming up in just a moment, we have an interesting story for you. It's a story about swapping dung beetles.
Rick Goddard for breakfast.
We have until 5 a.m. on Saturday, Hobart, to get a live site.
Mornings with Leon Compton.
Yeah, I was thinking about Bellrive Oval.
Groundsman wouldn't let anyone on that ground, surely.
Yeah.
For everything Hobart.
When I spoke with Lee Sales earlier, she says Sabra Lane could host it. Sabra Lane has texted in and says if Salesy wants to start making snacks for 5,000 guests, we're on.
Rick Goddard from 5:30 and Leon Compton from 8:30. Each weekday from 936 ABC Hobart. On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And don't forget, you can visit our ABC Rural Facebook page. Plenty of great stories there for you to peruse. And also ABC Rural Online. Some really good stories there as well. This one will go up over the weekend, and you can also have a look at it on the TV tomorrow night. Some little critters have made their way to Tasmania in a rather unique fashion. It's via express post. 5 years ago, a dung beetle exchange between South Australia and Northwest Tasmania began. Our reporter Mackenzie Archer went to the release at one Northwest Tasmanian dairy farm.
Dealing with livestock dung is a big issue for farmers. Some in northwest Tasmania are using dung beetles. Landcare facilitator at Cradle Coast Natural Resource Management, Tom O'Malley, hopes the exchange will increase the calendar coverage of dung beetles in the region.
Some are flowing. That's all right, we can't tell them what to do, can we?
Well, look, it started a bit by accident, really. We had a little newsletter article pretty much 5 years ago to the day, which Matthew read, and he rang up inquiring about the blue bomber dung beetles that we have here, which is Geotrupidae spinnaker, asking if he could get some. And I said, look, I can certainly send you some, Matthew, but it won't be till February next year when they're out again. He rang back the next day and said he'd trapped 4,000 Bubus bison on his farm, and he said, do you want me to send them your way? And I said, that'd be fantastic, Matthew. And so that sort of kicked things off, really. I sent him 4,000 or 6,000 back the following summer and autumn, and we've kept going since then, since 2021.
Why is there an exchange in place? We do have dung beetle species in Tasmania. Why not just use those populations?
Well, I guess our big seasonal gaps in Tasmania are winter and most of spring, whereas Matthew's gaps in South Australia, summer is a big one for him. So we have a species of beetle which can fill a gap for him. We're both getting a bit of benefit out of it. So that's the idea of it, really, to increase the calendar coverage of tunnelling dung beetle activity in Tasmania and in southern South Australia.
The dung beetles from South Australia come here in a pretty unique way. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
They're trapped in dung beetle traps, which are quite basic things, plastic tubs laid out in the paddock. But they're essentially at the mercy of the Australian Postal Service when they're sent here. So we have to trap them. We have to wash them quite meticulously to send them, separate any other non-target species that might be in there. And then we have to pack them in a specific media. We have to put them in a plastic box with air holes in, cable tie the box shut, put that box inside a post pack, pad it, and label the box very well to show what's in there, and then send it and keep your fingers crossed that it doesn't get lost or damaged, or, you know, it's the only practical way to send them. So, and it's, on the whole, it's been pretty successful. We haven't lost many.
When you tell people that you're going to pick up 4,000 dung beetles from the post office, what kind of reactions are you getting?
I've had some fairly enjoyable conversations with staff at the local post offices around Burnie as well. It is an interesting thing, sending living things through the mail. They make a bit of a sound in the box when you take the post packs in there, and if you've got 10 post packs to put on the desk, you can hear it from 5 or 10 metres away. So it's fairly obvious that you've got something living that you're sending.
That's great. What do the dung beetles do when they're released onto a farm?
Well, we'll release them on a farm like we have here today, and those beetles will then pair up. And they should hopefully start breeding almost immediately. We want them to come over from South Australia as early as we can get them and do most of their breeding when they're here rather than before they get trapped and sent here. So the idea is then that this species of beetle will do some breeding here, and for one pair of beetles that breed here successfully, they may be replaced with 20 to 30 new beetles next season from that pair.
What benefits do they offer farmers?
They offer quite a range of benefits in terms of what they do for productive agriculture and the environment. Through their tunnelling activities, a necessity of completing their life cycle, they reduce the bulk density of soil by mixing soil around, by cultivating it, excavating some to the surface. And those tunnels increase water infiltration into the soil profile, which will then reduce surface runoff in times of really heavy rainfall. They'll bury the dung as part of their breeding activities, and that dung and the nutrients in it will then become part of the root zone, part of the soil for the grass plants in the pasture and the other plants in the pasture. They also reduce the time that pasture might be fouled for. So while there's a dung pad out in the pasture there, a cow won't go and eat from that spot until that's gone. So they do a lot of mucky work, and they do it for free, really. So there's not a bad thing you can say about them, really.
I'm at Matthew Gunningham's Northwest Organic Dairy Farm, where 1,000 dung beetles have just been released.
That's not too bad. No, actually, you can see there's obviously some dung beetle activity still going on.
Yeah, there's still quite a bit of moisture.
So dung beetles are a fabulous organism. They really do amazing amount of good for soil health. I suppose as organic farmers we have very limited inputs that we can use, and so we're always looking for ways to harness nature to make our farm more productive and more resilient. And dung beetles are just something that really do an enormous amount of good.
How long have you been doing it for?
Well, so the farm had a certain level of dung beetle activity anyway, but over the last several years we've been working with Cradle Coast NRM to introduce some more species of dung beetles that will cover times of the year when we weren't getting a lot of activity. So it's been an ongoing project now for a number of years.
Have you seen some benefits?
Yeah, so we're now seeing much more activity later into the season. So, for instance, here we are in June, and there's still actually quite a lot of activity in the paddocks now that we can see where dung pats are being excavated and buried by dung beetles. And, you know, there's enormous benefits because they're mixing dung with the soil, and they're also creating their tunnels, which is aerating the soil and also creating places for the water to drain away as well. So it's great for aeration, it's great for drainage, and also mixing the dung much more quickly with the soil, dragging it down further into the soil profile, which just, you know, it's increasing the amount of fertility that's available to the plants in the paddock.
Do you see a future on the farm with more dung beetles, and are you going to continue this?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. As I said, you know, we're an organic farm, so we always look to nature, I suppose, as our pattern, you know, and we're always looking to harness more biodiversity on the farm in order to, you know, make the farm more resilient, more productive and work better. You know, and we see that, you know, the more of this type of thing that we can do, it certainly is going to benefit our business.
Yeah, that's Moorbenna dairy farmer Matthew Gunningham talking to Mackenzie Archer about the dung beetle swap between South Australia and Tasmania. Still to come on today's edition of the Country Hour, we have a huge increase in cattle numbers in feedlots across the country, and Richard Bailey will have the latest on the livestock markets both here and on the mainland. First up, the news headlines with Loretta Loberger.
Good afternoon, Tony. The man who killed Tasmania Police Constable Keith Smith in June last year has been sentenced to 40 years in prison with a non-parole period of 25 years. Justice Tamara Jago sentenced Lee Jeffrey Sushams at the Supreme Court in Burnie today for Constable Smith's murder and the aggravated assault of two other police officers. Ferry operator TT Line is preparing to move Spirit 5 from Hobart to Victoria, where it will undergo hull strength works. Over the past 2 weeks, the ship has been a floating art gallery for the Dark Mofo Festival. The Venezuelan government says its priority is rescuing people trapped underneath rubble as the death toll from the back-to-back earthquakes has risen to around 235. The magnitude 7.2 and 7.5 earthquakes that struck earlier this week were among the strongest in Venezuela in more than a century and were felt throughout the region. And King Charles will break almost two centuries of royal tradition by not living in Buckingham Palace as monarch after its refurbishment is complete. Royal officials say the King and Queen Camilla will work out of the palace, which will remain the ceremonial and operational centre of the monarchy, but they'll continue to live in nearby Clarence House, which has been King Charles's residence since 2003. More news at 1 o'clock.
Rick Goddard for breakfast.
And a bright, shining morning, actually. A bit of snow on the mountain.
Mornings with Leon Compton.
Good morning. If you've got short stays in the community, there could be a real buzz, and we're diving into it.
For everything Hobart.
It's a beautiful day outside.
Leon, I've got Tony at Ridgeway, and I've got Rod, and I get information from them every day. Rod has told me that the sun is up.
Rick Goddard from 5:30.
These men are not wasting their words.
And Leon Compton from 8:30. Each weekday from 936 ABC Hobart.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Yeah, just going back to our text line, Bradley tells me 2 millimetres of rain at Marrawarra in the northwest. He says dung beetles were put here 40-odd years ago. Not a big fan of dung beetles. And actually, Tiprat, the two at Myena, it's actually the temperature at the moment, not the amount of rain. So still 2 degrees at the moment up in the Central Highlands. There you go. Maybe some snow about. Well, a training program aimed at boosting job opportunities beyond the shearing industry has been launched in WA. The federally funded project called Beyond the Shed will support contractors and their teams through the transition away from the live sheep export market. And as Kate Forrester discovered, one of the main aims is to keep shearers in the local community.
Yellow on the side over.
It's a Thursday afternoon in the WA town of Jeremungup, and I'm spending the afternoon at the local sporting complex. Watching the next generation of kids learn how to play netball, and also chatting to them about why they love to live in the country.
You can go out in the bush on the motorbikes. All my friends, my true friends are here. I want to be a farmer. I want to, like, train pigs, chickens and cows. Because milk, ham, bacon. I love ham and bacon. And the chickens I can use for eggs pretty much all the time.
On the sidelines is coach Dale Parnell. It's a volunteer role Dale loves to take on, while also juggling her main job in the local shearing industry.
Keep going, Marla. Keep going.
Yep. I'm a shearing contractor here with my partner. Almost 2 years we've been contracting.
What got you into the shearing industry in the first place?
I grew up in the shearing industry. My dad was a shearer, so it's always been a part of my life. It's always been there, something I was always familiar with. And then when I left school, I decided to take it up full-time.
We're going to get 3 feet and we're going to put our hands over.
Across many regional towns, it's a similar story. Shearing teams are key parts of the local fabric.
Like, shearing contractors goes beyond just the service of shearing sheep. Contractors and their workers are, like, a huge backbone of the economic and social aspect of a small town. Yeah, so we employ anywhere between 10 and 20 workers at a time. They make their money in the area and they spend their money in the area. The money goes through the grocery store, goes through the pub, the roadhouse, the sports clubs. So it keeps the money flowing through the town.
But Dale is among many now facing uncertainty about their future. After the announcement of the 2028 ban on live sheep exports by sea, and as WA's sheep flock continues to fall, and shearing work becomes harder to secure.
21 years ago, when I started in the industry, we had 4 weeks a year. That was our downtime, off-season. And now that is 4 months a year that we don't have any shearing. A lot of it is, you know, just people going out of sheep, and the stopping of live export obviously had a lot to do with that.
It's this sentiment that prompted the WA Shearing Industry Association to come together and plan a way forward.
There we go. Come on.
$140 million was set aside to support the sheep industry transition away from live export, and part of that funding has gone towards launching an industry-led program called Beyond the Shed. The WA industry was given $2.2 million to help shearing contractors diversify their business.
I've got 2 months off.
And what do you reckon you want to do, like, say, next year in the 2 months off? What are some options of things you can do in that time?
Tiffany Davey is the training coordinator of Beyond the Shed.
A group of contractors who sat around a table and they came up with this program themselves. And then Wazia went ahead and knew that there would be a decline in sheep, and so was very proactive for their industry, on behalf of their industry, to rectify that problem.
A number of shearers recently completed a two-day agricultural training program near York, east of Perth, way different to a shearing shed.
So when you're ready, we can fire it up. That'll be the last thing you select.
Yeah.
Now you can bring your revs up now. So,
Wayne Lightbody was one of those leading the training sessions.
What are some of the things that you've been learning here today?
Basic care and maintenance of machinery and vehicles. And then as the day progresses and we get confident in their ability, we'll then put them in the machines and get them actually operating simple functions at first. But as they improve, more detail, like reversing a trailer, which they have to use mirrors on because you can't see behind because of the fire unit, how to safely lift up a shuttle and relocate it using the forks, picking up dirt or lime or gypsum and loading a spreader.
Yeah, hopefully it goes good, eh?
So far, over 90 shearing shed workers have signed up and nearly 30 contractors. Valerie Pretzel is the executive officer of the WA Shearing Industry Association. She says they really took their time making sure that the training was going to be useful.
Working out what exactly is it that we need that's practical and relevant and doesn't need days and days of sitting in a classroom. We want people to be able to be out and doing relevant practical skills. Then have people that are getting skilled up on work so the contractors can approach farmers that they have and say, okay, we've got people that have learned this equipment and these skills. What work have you got that we can help you with for the next 3 to 4 months while we're waiting for shearing to start up again? More broadly, we want a lot more of these. So this is just the first that we're getting up and running, and we're going to have livestock handling. Obviously, come harvest time, we'll be doing the same thing for that. Fencing courses, all sorts of things. Anything really that people are going to be able to work with and be able to earn money to keep them going in and around shearing.
That's Valerie Pretzel, Executive Officer of the West Australian Shearing Industry Association. And that story by Kate Forrester and Mark Bennett will feature on this Sunday's Landline program on ABC TV at 12:30, where you can catch up any time at ABC iView. Now, if you want to get involved in the training program, just search Beyond the Shed online. Talking wool, the final auction sales of the 25-26 financial year this week saw the Eastern Market Indicator drop 46 cents to finish at 1,943 cents. Now, this time last year, the EMI was 1,207 cents. So over the course of the season, the EMI has increased by 736 cents. This year, a total of just over 1.5 million bales was offered, almost 53,000 bales down on last year, and was driven by large falls in the merino fleece sector. But the value of the bales increased as the Eastern Market Indicator increased in value throughout the year. Now, coming up in just a moment, we'll hear about the numbers of cattle on feedlots in Australia.
Rick Goddard for breakfast.
I've just done a retaining wall with pellets. Yeah, it looks like dog's breakfast. Mm. But once the plants will grow up through it, well, it's going to be wonderful.
It'll look good, hopefully.
Mornings with Leon Compton.
By the way, I am lactic this morning.
Why are you lactic?
I actually went back to the gym yesterday.
Yay!
For everything Hobart.
Is this to get into shape by the media awards, Leon? Yeah. You're like James Bond or something.
Those days are over for me.
Rick Goddard from 5:30 and Leon Compton from 8:30. Each weekday from 9:36 ABC Hobart.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
We'll have Richard Bailey coming up for you very shortly to check what's happening in the livestock markets, but I can tell you the number of cattle in feedlots in Australia has more than doubled in the past decade. Our reporter Warwick Long caught up with Grant Gehry, the president of the Australian Lot Feeders Association, to find out more at a conference this week.
We're certainly seeing the cattle on feed in Australia grow to record levels. We're over 1.6 million head of cattle on feed today, and the capacity of the industry just under 1.8 million head. It's grown huge amount, especially
in the last
5 to 10 years.
And that's doubled in the last 10 to 12 years. That figure has doubled from 800,000 to 1.6 million.
Yeah, correct.
That's extraordinary growth.
Yeah, it's been extraordinary growth, and it's been underpinned by, you know, a lot of different factors, which I talked about today, a confluence of lots of different things. But global demand for beef has grown. As we've seen, people's incomes in developing countries grow. We know they eat more beef, and that's exactly what they do. And we're seeing demand for beef has never been higher.
And obviously then feed hasn't been really cheap through that period, although we're seeing grain markets come off a bit now. There's been droughts. There's been a lot thrown at the meat industry through this time, open markets and then closure of markets. But yet, this growth has continued. What is happening inside the meat industry now that has allowed this growth to continue with all of those, you know, hits that could be coming their way?
I think there's been a couple of things that have really increased over the last few years. We're now at a really great spot in terms of all the market access we've got around the world, and there's still work to do, but 91% of the markets we go to today are covered by some sort of free trade agreements. And like I said, there's more to do, but we're in a good spot there. So we've got a big diversity of markets. We've seen a huge rise in branded beef programs. And branded beef programs are largely underpinned by grain-fed production systems.
Yeah, so if I'm buying this brand, usually it comes with it that that animal has been on feed for a certain amount of days. Is that right?
Yeah, a lot of the time those products are grain-fed products and they are able to be produced 52 weeks of the year. The consumer can get them every week, every time they go to the restaurant or the supermarket. And those growth in those branded products of grain-fed beef have really underpinned that underlying demand for the product.
And from the grain-fed point of view, is you as somebody who's managing that kind of operation, you can produce the same type of steak consistently for 52 weeks and it's going to taste the same, look the same, and give that consumer the experience they want if they're going to part with as much money as they will for a steak.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The feedlot allows us to get around those climatic volatilities that we see, you know, dry seasons, wet seasons. We're able to manage through that and produce the same product every day.
So what percentage of the industry then, when we're thinking of cattle being put through abattoirs, what percentage of that is grain-fed now?
The last quarter, I think the March quarter, grain-fed cattle accounted for about 45% of the throughput.
So closing in on half.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what does it mean then for the processing and the cattle industry with feedlots and grain-fed growing? What are the outcomes then for beef?
It gives us a great continuity of supply, and it gives us the ability to target more premium products with higher marbling scores. We're able to feed cattle for longer to get higher marble scores and go into premium products, as well as, you know, more of the mid-fed type product that can be more of your everyday type product that people want. So we're able to tailor the product to where the consumer demand is.
And Greg Gary is with you from the Australian Feedlotters Association. So that's sort of the growth of the industry and the growth of the brands and what's underpinning the confidence in feedlots during all of these events that beef has been going through. Then there's the who is putting in feedlots and where is this capacity going? Is it a sort of family type operation? Is it a big corporate type operation? Who's building more feedlots?
Yeah, Warwick, it's across the board, but particularly we're seeing some of the family operations really grow and develop right across the country from Queensland right through to Victoria. We've seen family operations grow from 5 to 10,000 head right up to some as big as 30,000 head, which is just fantastic to see those families really growing and being successful in the industry.
And what's interesting that is we're talking generational change. That's generational change then in farming systems, you know, kids coming through or people looking at numbers saying we can make more money if we change our farming system from just putting animals out in a paddock and bringing them in to having a feedlot as part of a wider operation.
Yeah, my word, it gives a great base to some of these bigger farming operations. It gives a value add as well for, you know, farms that are big grain growing operations that have now got a feedlot as well. They can value add. So we're seeing it across the board. You know, there's, I think, over 80% of the feedlots in Australia are family owned, but we've also seen growth in the corporate sector as well. And a lot of the growth has come from feedlots that have been able to expand. So they're an existing yard, they've been able to expand, and that's been a good way to make that first step.
The expansion of feedlots, has that changed the type of animal that the industry wants producers to be producing for them that you're looking to buy through sale yards or off farmers?
Oh, I think it has, Warwick. The demand for feeder steers has definitely increased with the increased number of cattle on feed, and feeder steers are something that producers can look at producing, and they can potentially, you know, run a few more cows if they're turning off feeder steers and not trying to fatten them through to a grass-fed bullock. So that's an option in some areas. And don't get me wrong, you know, there's some great grass-fed programs out there and great brands as well, but where people choose, they can produce feeder steers and it can work really well for them.
And are you looking for a tall, lanky animal that'll grow out over those 90 days? Do you want a short, stocky animal? Does it matter?
One of the advantages of the feedlot industry is we produce a whole range of different products, right from a short-fed domestic animal, which might be that lighter, more early maturing type animal.
And how many days would that be on grain?
And that would be on grain for sort of minimum of 60 or 70 days, and then right through to, you know, our long-fed Wagyu production, long-fed Angus cattle that are, again, are on feed for a longer period of time. They're a bigger bigger animal that takes longer to finish.
And is it true that export markets, they're looking for a bigger carcass and a lot of the domestic markets want a smaller carcass? Is that
yeah, that's generally right. The domestic market is a lighter carcass, closer to that sort of 300 kilo mark, whereas in the export markets, they can handle a heavier weight.
So you're at nearly 50% of the industry now, 45% of the cattle in the last quarter. Does it keep growing, the feedlot capacity, or do you plateau?
We think it'll continue to grow. It may not grow at the rate it's grown in the last 5 or 10 years, but we do believe the industry is going to keep growing. I think one of the challenges for people is just the cost of construction today. It's very expensive to go out and build a feedlot, and I think that will temper some of the expansion for a period of time, but the growth will continue.
That's Grant Gehry from the Australian Lot Feeders Association talking there to Warwick Long about the huge numbers of cattle in Australian feedlots. We'll go to the livestock markets for you in a moment.
Why are our vaccination rates falling?
We see the herd immunity drop across a whole lot of different preventable illnesses. It'd be a real tragedy.
I'm Early Ward here, Tassie Cast on ABC Listen Now.
Keeping you updated every day. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Okay, time on a Friday afternoon to check the latest on the livestock markets with our reporter Richard Bailey. How are you going, Richard?
Going very well, Tony. Going very well.
We're past that shortest day. Days are getting longer and, heading towards spring.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We, it's pretty interesting that it's pretty good season through a lot of eastern Australia, and then obviously there are still some pretty dry areas as well. But it's certainly playing havoc with the amount of livestock on the market. There's definitely shortages of a lot of good quality cattle and certainly sheep and lambs. So these next, between now and the end of September, will be pretty interesting, I reckon.
Okay, let's look at the cattle market first up. What's happening?
Okay, most cattle markets for eastern Australia were a bit cheaper during the week, but you've got to remember they were coming off some pretty long runs of higher prices, over the last sort of month or 6 weeks. A lot of your trade cattle, 460 to 520 cents, did see some veelers hit 554, I think. Grown steers and bullocks, wide range here, but depending on which market you're in, 450 to 530 cents. And most of your heavy cows are sort of 390 to 440 cents. I did see a report out of one of the Queensland markets, Dalby, I think, saying that most of their cows struggle to make 400 cents. So there's probably maybe a little bit of pressure on there. It'll be interesting, Tony, to see. We've filled our quota into China now, which means that any beef that we send into China now creates a 50% tariff. And so we probably won't be sending a lot of beef that way. But the same, Brazil are almost in the same boat. They're almost to fill their quota, and they're going to have to find places to send their beef as well. And the most likely places we're all going to try and go is more into the United States. So it'll be interesting to see how that all pans out, I reckon. And we've got some other pretty good markets in Southeast Asia as well, but the Chinese market's pretty important. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out for the rest of the year. That'll be an interesting wait and see, I reckon.
Yeah, I reckon. And, the Chinese public, they'd be wanting to know why the scarcity of beef, I suppose,
I was thinking exactly the same yesterday when I was writing a story. I thought to myself, we're only halfway through the year and you would think that we're going to sell very little beef to there and so are Brazil. You'd think make a shortage over there. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, I suppose they might change their mind halfway through the year. I don't know, but that's where it is at the moment.
Yeah. Anything else in the cattle market we should know?
No, I don't think so. We're 3 weeks away from another store sale. That same week, I think Smithton have got a sale on the Monday as well. So there'll be two lots of store sales that week. Don't know anything about numbers at this point in time.
Right. Now, lamb and sheep, how are they going?
Yeah, this market is continuing to just – lamb market's continuing just to edge up each week. About like this time last week, most of our extra heavy lambs were just shy of 1,100 cents or thereabouts. Well, this week they were more like a bit over 1,100 cents, and it meant your trade lambs were more like 1,200 cents and better. Wagga yesterday, smaller numbers again, and a lot of their trade lambs averaged over 1,200 cents. So that means there were lambs certainly that made 1,300 cents a kilo. Extraordinary money. But as I've said before, if you're going to keep lambs till this time of the year, you deserve to get paid. But that's on the back of smaller numbers. Mutton market also very, very strong, 900 to 1,000 cents a kilo. And yesterday at Wagga, they quoted the vast majority of their mutton over 1,000 cents a kilo. So that's very, very, very strong. We've never seen that sort of money.
That's amazing prices, isn't it, for mutton? Seriously.
Well, it's interesting because talking to a couple of the wool guys on Tuesday, and they were telling me that a lot of the Tasmanian shearers have almost run out of sheep at the moment. Now, that hasn't happened, I don't know, for more than a decade.
Yeah.
And it comes back to this mutton price where, I mean, people, you know, instead of keeping withers, they're now selling them as whether lambs or one-year-olds because they can get so much money for them. And when I first came back from the mainland in 73, I think it was quite normal that the shearers during the winter would go fencing or whatever. They'd do something else. And then we got to a stage over the next many years where we shore all year round. And, look, it was this time, well, I suppose it was this time last year, a little bit before, we couldn't find shearers to shear the lambs, let alone anywhere else. So it's quite a big turnaround there. The other thing that is interesting is that there are quite a lot of meatworks that are either on limited shifts, and some of them have actually closed for maintenance breaks. And a couple of them I know of are closing for a little bit longer, a week longer than they would normally close for. And once again, that's on the basis of much smaller numbers. So, as I said, very interesting time between now and spring.
Okay. All right, Richard, you have a great weekend.
Good on you, Tony.
Yeah, Richard Bailey back with us next Wednesday to check the latest weekly Power Renner sale. I'll put a podcast of today's program up for you and have a happy weekend. We'll catch you after midday Monday.